Ellen Fenwick first came to the Villa Meridiana in April. Long before the train ran into the station at Florence, she had been sitting on the edge of the seat, a starter poised for a race, handbag, overcoat, and umbrella disposed on one arm, so as to leave the other free for her luggage. She recognised that she had not had the same grip on the wagon-lit attendant as the companion who had shared her sleeper as far as Pisa. This woman, the wife of an hotel keeper in Lucca, with a daughter married in England, had chattered to her in bad English ever since they found themselves in the same compartment at Calais. But she was a hardened traveller who, with one wave of her hand in its tight black glove, subdued the unknown terrors of the journey, and left Ellen free for enjoyment. Replying, "Yes? Really? Do you? That must be nice for your daughter." She sucked into her eyes the mountains of northern Italy, the pink farms, and the interrupted glimpses of the sea, appearing between the rattling tunnels. Now it was dark, and she was alone. To watch the signora, who had been her family in space for 24 hours, stump away under the platform lights of Pisa, between her husband and son who had come to meet her, was, for Ellen, the final parting from home. As soon as the train left Pisa, she opened the door of the cabinet de toilette and looked at herself in the mirror, partly to make sure that she was tidy, partly to reaffirm her identity. The mirror showed her an image which, to eyes whose horizon was already widening, appeared slightly comic. She had not cut her hair short, in the fashion, but wore it in two thick plaits, coiled over her ears. The new felt hat, which in the shop had seemed to settle harmoniously on the coils, now proved only to be comfortable if she allowed it to slip forward over her nose. She pushed it back, relentlessly driving the hairpins into her ears. The lifted brim exposed a candid forehead, delicate eyebrows, and grey eyes smudged beneath with fatigue and strain. The cheeks were too thin for the bone structure of nose and chin. It was the kind of face that suggests a daughter taking after her father. Ellen, when she looked at it again, always hoped that it would have improved since her last inspection, but did not often think that it had. She put a finger under one hairpin and tried to relieve the pressure, but as soon as she removed the finger, the hat drove the hairpin back. Well, she must suffer so as to arrive looking like a suitable governess, and, perhaps, at the villa she need not wear a hat. Mrs. Rivers had written that they were 5 miles out of Florence. She hoped that Miss Fenwick liked a country life. Ellen had made an imaginary picture of Mrs. Rivers, seeing her, the mother with the little girl, an authoritative figure, much older and wiser than herself, invulnerable, the mother seen by the little girl. Ever since Lady Gressingham had told her that Madeline Rivers was Rose Danby's daughter, the image had crystallized into something like Rose Danby's stage presence. This had been, for Ellen, the thing that cinched her decision to take the job for the summer. She had looked blank with astonishment when Lady Gressingham, telling her about Madeline Rivers, had added, "Poor girl, it's not so easy, you know," the old woman remarked, "to be a famous person's child." But, Ellen thought, so interesting. She had always been stage-struck. The treats that she had enjoyed most from her first pantomime had been visits to the theatre. Rose Danby, whom she had seen whenever she had an opportunity, had stimulated her sense of life as it really was, but was so seldom allowed to be. This made the prospects of 6 months in a villa in Italy as governess to Rose Danby's granddaughter so dazzling, and so unlike anything that had ever happened to her, as to outweigh the inevitable terrors of one desperately homebound for 7 years.